Yep. Is anyone at the Upfest? Sweet. Yeah, the Upfest was held on Monday and Tuesday. It's about 150 developers all just powering out applications on Windows 8, mostly. And I think that there were 29 demos produced in the 24-hour period from 11 o'clock on Monday to 11 o'clock on Tuesday. So it's pretty cool. All Windows 8. So welcome. My name's Jordan, and I'm a solution architect for a company called Xamling, which I run with my two brothers, family business. And we've been going for a couple of years now. So basically, head across to our site if you want to get in contact, Twitter at Jackage. Any questions you got throughout the session, please yell them out as I'm talking along. I'd rather answer them in place, in context, than right at the end. I'm Silverlight MVP for the last 3 years. So sort of started with main Silverlight and then it's gone through Silverlight and Phone, and now we're doing some XAML C#, the progression of Silverlight and Windows 8. So thank you, Windows 8, I still have a job. So before I get into the talk too much, I just wanted to give a bit of background about who we are at Xamling and some of the things we've done, because I think it's really important to talk about a couple of the developments that we've done over the history of our company and to stage today's talk. So basically, Xamling's a consumer-focused development company. So we build applications that target consumers, as opposed to like enterprise applications or business-focused applications. So applications, it's an interesting area to be in, because you actually have to build applications that people want to use, that they like. So, there's a lot of user experience, whereas you can just force business applications onto people. So good user experience, you've usually got to be really quick to market, because there's usually the people that we're building for have got an immediate need to get this application out because they need to make money out of it. They need to be very high quality. Consumers have no patience for crappy software. And so we've built quite a few. We've built on every major XAML platform, actually. So we've done Windows 8. We've got an app in the store. We've done Xbox. So we actually built SBS On Demand for Xbox, which is available on every Xbox in Australia. All XAML-based. If you've got a Telstra Windows Phone 7, we've got two of our applications on there, the Foxtel and the Telstra One application. We've also done one for Nova FM, which is a shopping thingo, and a bunch of other stuff. But the point being is that the things I'm actually going to talk to you about today started with Silverlight, and the same techniques have worked on Windows Phone through HTML5 as well. And now we're going to look at that the same way that we build applications, I guess. Now on Windows 8, the latest progression of XAML. So I just want to point out, just before I get started, this is not an MVVM intro talk. We've sort of set up the tracks this year at TechEd, so then there's been a couple of MVVM talks that slowly introduce you to the concept of MVVM. But what I want to do today is take MVVM and then build on top of it. Show you how you can use MVVM to take your applications and your development processes to the next level. So the idea being is that for this session, you're either already using MVVM, which is a lot of people in here already were, you're either about to start using it, or maybe you've just heard about it recently and want to get some more idea, and you haven't quite mastered MVVM yet. But rather than, taking away every single little code snippet from this talk, think about how the concepts might apply. So it's more conceptual. I'm talking concepts, but I'm obviously going to do a lot of code demos. So the question is it a Microsoft recommendation that you do everything on MVVM? It's not, but it certainly is a really good idea. So Microsoft doesn't say you should do MVVM or you shouldn't, because both ways can be good depending on the project that you're building. I think most of the specialist community would say MVVM every single time. So, we're going to take MVVM, and we're going to take it and put a platform. We're going to build on top of it. We're going to add some conventions, some patterns. To really shoot your applications up to the next level of awesomeness. We're going to use really simple techniques. Like, the things I'm going to show today are not complex once you break them down. We're going to condense a lot into the session, but when you really go away and think about it, the ideas are really simple. And because they've got to be simple, because the whole idea of what I'm going to show you is to make life easier for both the developers on your project and the designers. So at Xamling, we're a small company. There's three of us. A designer and two developers. And we've got some big clients, and we actually compete against some really, really great software development companies that are a lot bigger than us. And so I think one of the core businesses that we, well, one of the core ideas at Xamling when we first started was we must continually improve our development process. We have to streamline. We have to really, really work hard to make sure that we're doing as little as possible when we're building our applications, so that way we can concentrate on actually, you know, making them look great and work great. So, yeah, I just want to give you just a quick overview of MVVM in my own words. It's actually really hard to explain because it's not a thing you install. It's like a set of rules and regulations and ideas, and it's almost like a technique that you train your team in rather than you install as a Visual Studio template or something like that. So we'll just quickly run through it. I don't want to spend too much on this. In my own words, MVVM is, okay, it's obviously Model View View Model. So that's what it actually stands for. Now, while we're reading backwards from right to left across this diagram, I want you to remember one rule, that the thing to the right is not allowed to know about the thing to the left, but the thing to the left is allowed to know about the thing to the right. So to get started, we've got the model. Now, the model would be something like loading something from a database, say a list of people. Just remembering the rule, it's not allowed to know about the view model or the view. Why would something that's loading a piece of data from a database know how to display that? It really shouldn't. In fact, there might not even be a view in the system. It might be a cloud service running up on the internet somewhere, who knows? So the point I'm making is that each piece of code, each section of this should only know about itself. It knows how to load data. Now we move across to the view model. Now the view model, because the model is to the right of it, it's actually allowed to know about the model. So it goes off to the model and says, I want to get a list of people. It then goes and prepares that list of people and exposes it via property and just leaves it sitting there in that property. So it's just a C# class that has a property on it. The view comes along and it's kind of allowed to know about the view model. Kind of. It's a bit tricky. So the view model's exposed this property. The view then comes along and through declarative data binding, it actually starts pulling the properties in. So if it's a list of people, it might choose to show it in a list box. The view model's just exposed a list of people. It doesn't know if it's going to be in a list box or in a grid view or anything like that. It's just a list of people. It's got no idea about the view, how it's going to be displayed. The view, on the other hand, has got no idea how that got loaded or anything like that. So I can go up to the designer and I can say, hey, designer, there's a list of people in this property. Or even better, I can say there's going to be a list of people in this property. The idea with decoupling the view from the view model is that the designer can go in and it's like, what's that people list called again? People? All right. And they can go in, they can build out the list of people and make it look great on the screen without the view model even being written yet. They can just use some sample data. So the view model, the view should be written in such a way that the view model can just be switched out, replaced with the sample data view model or the real view model at runtime. And it's up to the designer to choose where to suck in the pieces to put onto the view. So we decouple the code from the view. The whole idea with this is to introduce better workflows, to reduce dependencies between design and development sides. So I can go through and write my entire application, just bang out all the view models without any of the views attached. Same thing on the other side. The designer can go through and write out all the views without having to worry about any of the view models. And I just want you to keep that in mind as we're going through the talk today, because it's going to become more obvious exactly what I'm talking about. So as I said, it's not something you install, it's an idea, it's a set of rules, it's something that you train in, it's something you're good at. You're not going to be the best at it on day one. But all of that left and right stuff, all the diagrams and everything like that, there's two rules that I keep in mind whenever I'm doing MVVM stuff. And that is, code without worrying about the view. So don't even think there's a view on your application. Doing MVVM correctly, you should be able to code the whole thing without any views in the system. Your entire application should be able to run from the command prompt, pretty much. Same thing on the design side. Designers work really well when they're just thinking about how to lay things out and how to make things look really good, as opposed to having to worry about the code, you know, like, oh, I've got to put this text box in. Can you go into the code and fix it up and hook it up for me? They don't have to worry about any of that. They can just design. And it's all done through data binding. So the end result, MVVM, when done properly, is awesome design and developer workflows, which is pretty much the reason that data binding and then MVVM were invented. So I said at the start, we're not actually going to be talking purely about MVVM, we're going to build on top of it. So that's this next bit that I'm talking about now. So there's more to great projects than simply banging in MVVM and then you're done with it. There is so much more, and there's some great little tips that I'm going to give you today to really boost efficiency in your applications. The first problem, and this is the most common problem I see when I go into an organization to help them, you know, improve a product or help them get started, and it's around view selection and navigation. How do you choose which view to show? So when the application needs to go to a new view, for example, I've got my list of people, and I click on a person, and then I need to figure out, you know, well, there's got to be some way to show this person in the system. I need to know which view to show. I need to know which view model to load and get it to, and pass in data to it. Once I navigate to the view, I need to figure out what to do with the view model and how to apply it and everything like that. So I just want to highlight this piece of code, and this is directly from File New Project on a Windows 8 application. This.frame.navigate. Type of page 2, and some data. Now, if you break it down, think about it for a moment, that has actually violated both sides of the fence. There's a view that knows about code, and there's a code that knows about view. For starters, that is a piece of code, and it's got a page 2 view in it. So it knows about a view that exists. How do I make this piece of code work if there's no views in the system? Secondly, once I get to page 2, I've got to do something with that data. I've got to somehow pass it in a view model or create a view model, and apply it to the page. So I think, yeah, this is called view first navigation, and I think it sucks. Do you like what I did there? S-U-X, that's pretty cool. what I'm going to introduce today is something called view model first navigation, and this is a very, very important concept. So rather than creating the view and everything, why don't we work as much as possible in the code and then hand off to some pre-written code that can go and figure out which view to show. So basically the idea is we're going to create a view model and then we're going to configure it. So we can create it and configure it at the same time. So for example, we create a new view model that's like a person detail view model and pass in the person that we want to show, all in the one piece of code. And then instead of navigating to the view, we actually navigate to the view model, which might sound interesting. Basically what we're doing is we've got this new view model that's got the stuff in it that we need to show on the screen, passes into the navigation system, and once it's been passed in the navigation system, the view model side forgets about it. The navigation system goes, hey, I need to show this view model, and using a piece of convention, a naming convention, it can actually go through and figure out which view to show automatically and link up all the view models and everything like that. I see everybody in the crowd going, what the hell is he talking about? So I knew that was going to happen. So let's have a code demo and let's go and have a look at model first navigation. So I've actually got a little bit of an application that I've put together already. And at the moment, it's pretty blank. Let's just check that it's working. So the idea is that I've got this application, I've got a database, and the database has got a list of parks in it. The idea is you can find a park that you want to go and visit with your children on the weekend, and you can see if they've got toilets or barbecues, and you can also see where they are, so it's got a bit of geolocation and everything like that. And so I've gone so far already in my application as to go and grab some data out of the database and have it ready to do up some views. Okay, so first up, what we're going to do is we're going to start by creating a home view model. Now, most applications use main page as their first thing. What we're going to do is we're going to leave main page out of it today, and we're actually going to go straight in and start creating some views and view models. Now, the way I like to lay out my projects is I like to have a view folder that has all the view stuff, and then you know you can put all your common stuff somewhere else. And then underneath the view folder, I like to break that out further into a nice hierarchy of things. But for now, we just need a home view. So I'm just going to add a new item, And it's going to be a blank page because we're going to navigate to a page. I'm going to call it Home View. Add him in. And I'm also going to add a Home View model. Now, this is where the naming convention comes in. It's very, very important that I call this Home View model. And I'm just going to base it on something here, and we'll get to what that is in a minute. So I've created a Home View and a Home View model. So basically what I can do is I can actually now go and if I try and navigate to Home View model, it can figure out how to relate that back to the Home View. So we'll step through that. Just another little thing just before I do that, you'll notice that it's actually gone and put the view model underneath the XAML file there, just like the CS file. There's a little registry hack that you can install, and if you want it, come and see me after. And it actually goes and does that for you, so it tucks everything nicely away, rather than having your view models in another folder or something like that. So it's really nice and neat. Just quickly, I've just got to convert this guy to a layout-aware page. Now, we'll get to why that is later. And the layout-aware page is actually built into the Windows 8 framework. It's just that when I create them here, I have to manually do it. And it's hugely important later on. 5 points to the first person who can tell me what's wrong with this method that comes in by default. So yes, that's correct. But the problem with it is that it's actually created the onNavigator2 override, but it doesn't call its base class, which is very, very confusing, because people will go away and edit their layout-aware page base class, which is actually included in the project as well. This is part of the template, so that's actually a piece of code that comes with Windows, but it never calls its own base things. And so I actually ran into this problem quite often, that it's a bit of a funny template, like it should be calling its own base class. So I've put in Home View. Let's just go and put some text in the guy, just so we can see it when we get to it. So we'll go text equals hello room 50. It's not often you get to use 50 font size. So all right, next up. So what I've done next is I'm going across into the app.xaml.cs, which in Windows 8 applications, much like Windows Phone and Silverlight, is the bootstrapper for the entire application. So this is the code that's run when your application first launches. And if I scroll down a bit, there's just a piece of standard code that comes with Windows. Basically, it's creating a frame. Now, a frame is actually is the object that Windows 8 uses to navigate around various pages. So, and it sounds really scary, but it actually is a pretty simple control. If I actually go and have a look at the object browser on it and have a look at its base class, you can see that frame's actually just a content control. So there's a lot of controls in the system that are just content controls. The idea of the content control is it can take a piece of content like a view model or a class or anything like that and apply a template onto it. So just about every control in the system that's even remotely dynamic is a content control, including list box items and buttons and everything like that. As part of keeping it simple, I don't want to like replace the frame. I don't want to write my own. I just want to use as much as I can of the framework, but just make little adaptions as I go along. So this is all just part of the code that comes with Windows. Where I'm going to start with my own bits is that I've got this little class called it's called an X-Frame View Model Base, and basically its job is to go and wrap around the frame that comes with Windows, and just give it a little bit of a push towards the MVVM side of things rather than the way that it's built. So you notice this bit of code down here that's been commented out, bad, bad, bad. This is the default code that came with Windows. And it's saying reframe, navigate to, type of main page. It's breaking a couple of those laws that we talked about. So rather than do that, what I can actually do is I can actually go X frame. Home view model. And then, so what I'm doing there, I'm saying to the frame, create a content model, which is a view model. So I could have just newed up the home view model directly, But in this little framework that we're using today, it's best if you run them through this little factory process here that creates it for you. It links up things like you can get your parent view models. This is especially important when view models have create children view models, which we'll be doing soon. So once we've created that view model, we can actually then just navigate to that. X-frame. To VM. Okay. So let's set a breakpoint there and just run up the application. All right, so we've gone ahead and we've actually created the VM. If I go through and have a look at all its base types, I can see that this is what I was talking about by running it through the factory. It's got things like parent model. It's got all this extra stuff that just helps me build my application so I can sort of run back up the hierarchy. I can use navigate to calls and things from within the view model itself without having to run out to the X-frame every time. So I'm just going to put a breakpoint there, and we're about to see what the hell I'm talking about. All right, so let's step into Navigate 2. I'm just going to step through. So there's a couple of Navigate 2 overrides there. All right, so basically Navigate 2, we've gone into what I call the navigation service, which takes the view models that I want to navigate to and figures out what to do with them. It's actually quite a simple little class. I mean, all it's doing is it's setting us up to know where we came from. So it's figuring out what the previous model was, just in case we want to go back and reference it later. It's setting some properties like, am I navigating forwards or backwards, just in case I want to figure out if I want to do a reverse animation or a forward navigation. It figures out if I can go back. So that way I can have a button that appears or not based on data binding if I'm on the home page or a different page. So I can have the back button automatically appear. Now, this is where the magic happens. Basically, the navigation framework has a current object. This is the object that's on the screen at the moment. And when it gets set, we hit this do navigate piece of code. Now, what this is doing is that, first of all, it goes and finds out the name of the view model, the home view model. I'll just increase that text size, actually, while I'm doing that. Can't do it while I'm running. Hey? Yeah, it'll only do it in this window, though. I'll have to do it for everyone. If I go and hover over that, I can see I've got the view model there, the home view model, and just a really simple string replace to replace it to the replaces the fully qualified name from home view. You can't really read that. Let me just zoom in. Whoa. Okay. Too much zoom. All right, we're right back out. Anyway, it replaces the home view model type name with home view, and then it goes off, and then finally we get back to that piece of code that we saw that it actually enables the frame to navigate. So it's automatically picked up the view model name and replaced it with the view and is automatically navigating to that view now. So the view model doesn't know about the view, and the view doesn't know about the view model. This little piece of code doesn't actually know about the view or the view model. It's completely agnostic. It just takes a type name and replaces it and then forces that frame to navigate. And we'll see why this is good in a minute. So if I click on that now, we'll bring it up, and we can see Hello Room. So it's just that one line. Once I've gone through all that junk, and this is part of the framework, once I've gone through all that junk, I can just start banging out view models. You saw how quickly I added that new view and then navigated to it. I added two files and then two lines of code, and I was able to navigate views. I can navigate forward and back just as easily. The question was that navigation code we just saw my code, and it is. And I've got a download link at the end of the presentation to grab all of this stuff and play around with. So, first up, we create a view and ensure it ends in the word view, for example, homeview.xaml. And then we go ahead and create a view model and ensure it ends in the words view model. And the system goes ahead and detects the name and automatically displays the view. So that's step one. We've managed to solve the problem with View first navigation. Okay, so this is where it gets exciting. This is where we actually start seeing some of the impact of what we're going through. At a start, it might seem like that's a lot of stuff to get in place to get an application going. But in reality, once you've done it once and you import the library, you can just start adding views straight away. In fact, this whole project that I set up for this talk today, when you see in its finished state, it actually only took me just under an hour to do it. Just copying and pasting bits from other projects and using this library. But this is where the fun stuff starts. So we've talked about navigating to entire pages, which is okay, and it's certainly a really good practice to get into. But where the real fun starts, where the real efficiencies come from, and when you actually start doing a similar technique to the items in a page. So, you know, you've got the page itself, homeview.xaml. What about dynamically choosing sub-items in the page, like user controls? So, for example, in a grid view. So let's have a look at one that I prepared earlier. All right. What we've got here, this is a grid view. It's got a list of groups along, and it's got a list of items in each group. Now, you can see that the actual items are different types of content. Now, that's interesting because here we've got a large tile, we've got a medium, these ones here are just buttons, these ones don't even have images at all. And if we go and have a look at how the grid view works, it becomes a little bit interesting. So we want to be able to add items into a list, which is what the grid view takes, but depending on the item, we want it to be able to show a different type of content. So what I'm going to show you next is how to have a multi-content grid view, which is a hugely important thing and something that people are really struggling with introductory Windows 8 applications. A multi-content grid view without actually hard-coding the content into it. We want to use all these dynamic things that we've been looking at already. So let's just quickly go through what a grid view is. It's basically, I mean, you've seen what it is on the screen. It's that Windows 8 cool-looking thing that they use on all the home screens, like in the store, and they use it in all sorts of applications. But in the background, what it really is actually it gets fed a list of lists. So it gets fed a series of groups, and each one of those groups has a title, and it has a list of children. So in the application we just saw, we've got featured, we've got programs, we've got news, and each one of those sections has their own child's objects. So, for example, we've got the featured objects, which are all different controls because they're all different sizes and have different content on them. And then you've got the buttons as well, you know, like I want to view all or view most popular or something like that. And that's obviously a different type of content. Now, the problem being is that we've just fed in a list of objects into the actual grid view. How does it know how to choose, how to display them? So for starters, we pass into the children lists of the view model, sorry, of the grid groups, we pass in view models. And we've actually just realized that we can actually dynamically choose content based on what view model we're trying to show. So back to the convention we talked about a minute ago. We create a view. Now, the reason why we call them views and not pages or something like that, because view is a common term for a piece of UI, but it is a discrete piece of UI. So a page is a view, and a user control is also a view. It's just a common terminology for both of them. So this time, we create a user control, but it still has a view model. Even though it's not an entire page, each segment of the page also has its own view models. So there's view models everywhere. And then basically, yeah, we go ahead and dump those view models into the groups, and then they have their own child view models, and then we'll somehow get them to lay out on the screen as part of the grid view. So let's go back to code and have another look. Let's go to show. Okay, so let's just talk through it for a minute. We wanted to show the featured parks on the screen. The designers come back and said that we need to have one of them big, one of them a little bit smaller, and a couple of ones off the bottom that are even smaller still. And there's also the ability to view all featured parks. So there's actually four types of content there: the large, the smalls, the medium, and also a button that does some things. So let's go through and create another view model. Now, this time it's going to be called home feature view.model. Yes. All right. This time I'm going to do the fonts properly. Is that big enough down the back? Awesome. I did all my practices at 1024 by 768, which is what they've had every other year. This year I rock up and they've got HDMI and it can run at full resolution, so I wasn't quite prepped for the awesome new screens. So I've got this home feature view, and this time I'm going to base it on a different class, and I'll explain why I'm doing that in a minute. And this time we're going to be called group items view model base. Okay. So what I've done is I've got my home view, I've got my home feature view. I need to go through and, first of all, my home feature view is going to show a list of parks. So I'll start preparing my view model to take a list of parks from somewhere. My home view is going to pass it in. Okay. Now I'm just sorry, apologies for copying in the code. There's a simple code, but it's there's just a bit of it, that's all. So first of all, I'm going to set the title of my feature view model to featured. This featured view model is going to be one of the groups in the home view model. And then what I need to do is actually go and do the work and add in the child view models. Okay, so this is where we start realizing that we're going to be doing something dynamic later on. So let's just take it one piece at a time. So the first bit there, where we're creating the main feature tile, this bit of code here, basically we go off and we create the large tile view model. Now the large tile view model takes a park. In fact, they all take a park. And the reason that they can all take a park is that all these view models that we're adding in here are actually based on the same item. So what we do is we actually go ahead and write a view model that supports a park, and then the only reason why we inherit from it into the large, the small, the medium, and everything like that is so then at a later stage we can dynamically choose how to display it on the screen. So the actual home feature view model itself, sorry, the large tile view model itself, is actually very simple. It's just that one tiny little view model that takes a park can display, can dynamically display entire sections on a grid view. So the coding is so minimal. Next, yes.
Why would you do it the other way around, where you have a large tile?
Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you...
So like if you go back to your large tile view model, why wouldn't you have a park item view model that inherits from the large tile view model? So you wouldn't have to...
The problem is that it's going to actually use the last item in the inheritance change to choose how to display it. Basically then we go off and we create all these other view models. They're all really simple. They're just based on the same thing. We've got large, skinny, we pass in the parks. It's really, really simple. And then you'll notice that we're adding them all to the same collection though. So, yes?
Wouldn't making those be essentially making the view model aware of the view? Because the only real reason you're making that class is for the name of the view.
Yes, but the thing is that we're actually adding these into... a collection of generic objects, and then we decide later how to hook up the view. So yes, at some point that
the
convention...
That existing is for the name of the view, isn't
it? Yeah, so it's a convention. So basically the convention enables us to add these generic view models into a generic list and then defer the linking back up of that view to that object. So we can actually then push the selection of the view and the view model. We can actually do the dynamic selection of the view at a much later time. So we're deferring it until we actually get into the grid view. Otherwise, you'd have to add, I'm not even sure how you could do this without doing it this way. I don't know how you could add a dynamic list of objects into a collection that then shows up in a grid view as all different items. You'd have to hard code it. And any convention has names that are similar. That's just how they work. So I've got the large tile view model. The large tile view model lives with the large tile view. It's underneath it, so it's okay to have the same name. The idea is, though, that I can add all these items to this collection without the view, without even a view attached. And I'll show you how that works in a second. So I go and create my large tile, my small tile, my skinnies, everything like that. Down the bottom, I've even got a tile button view model, and I add that to the items as well. And so let's go across now and actually, first of all, we need to load the list of parks to pass into this guy. And then we'll go and add a grid view and get that guy populating. So back in home view model, I haven't done anything. Oops, I did forget something. Something called load parks. Okay. Just make sure that I'm actually calling that guy. All right, so in the home view model is sort of like it represents the page that's going to display the grid and everything. So its job is to actually load some parks. And then when we create the child view models, like the featured view model, we can just pass that list of parks in so they don't actually have to load it themselves. Okay. Feature view model. To call it view model. Could have been the end of everything. So basically here, what I'm doing is, first of all, I'm going off to my pre-written repo. It's just a very simple repo that grabs a list of sample data. And then I create my home feature view model. But instead of navigating to it, this time I'm just adding it in as one of the groups. So the view models are quite flexible. They can either be in type pages, they can just be items in a list. You can do anything with them. And then it's up to the view to decide how to consume them, whether or not it runs it through something dynamic or whether they write their own data template to show it. It's completely up to the other side of the fence to decide what to do with them. And just for brevity, I've added a second view model so we can actually see a list of parks. So the first one's got some featured... so we can see a list of groups. The first one's got the featured one. It's going to pop up and do all the different sizes. The second one's just recently added, and they're all just the same. They're not featured or anything like that. So we need to call that init. Okay. So now when the view model gets loaded, it will automatically go and load off the parks, even before we navigate to it. It doesn't know anything about that. Okay. So what I'm going to do now is I'm actually just going to go across to the view side of things and create the the grid view. So the grid view is that control that we saw that lays the items out all across the page. So let's go into the home view here. It's quite empty at the moment. Let's paste in, first of all, we need a data source. Now, this isn't a totally new concept, but the idea is that we actually have group data. So we've got a series of groups, and as I said, each of those groups has items. So we're going to run it through a collection view source, which knows how to deal with group data. So you can see here, it's got a couple of properties on it. Is the source grouped? We're binding it to all groups, which is basically the parent view models, like the feature view model, the recently added view model. And then it's got the items path. The featured view model and the recently added view models have got an items property on it that contain all the child view models once again. So we're going down through all these levels. They contain all the child view models that are actually going to be rendered as the items in the page. So it's basically just giving it's a data source that can be configured to work with all sorts of different objects. In this case, we want to bind to all groups, and we want to get our items for each of the groups out of the items property. Oops. Okay, so next I'm just going to paste in the grid view. Now, all right, let's quickly go through this guy. What time is it? All right, so basically a grid view, it's just like a list. In fact, you build it up exactly the same as a list box or any other control you might have worked with before. So it's got like item templates and items, panels and things like that. It's got a group style though. This is a new thing. So basically the group style, it's not so new, but group style is something you might not have used before. And so each item in the group, we can tailor the header, we can do all that sort of thing. Remember I set the title before on the view model and I called it featured. That's going to spring up there. we can customize the items panel. So the items panel template that I'm using here is actually a variable size wrap grid. Now that's a cool little thing. It works like a stack panel except it wraps at the end of the line. But in this case, it actually can have each item a different size, which is something very, very cool and very new. So variable size wrap grids is a great little control to use. But the real fun begins is in the item template. Now remember I said the grid is just like a list. So this same principle that we're about to see would work in a list, it would work in a button, it would work in anything that uses content controls. So the item template for the grid view, which is each of the squares that will be shown on the screen, is actually one of these dynamic content controls. So a dynamic content control can go in, it can say, what's the item you're passing me? So it goes through the list of all those view models, all the different ones. And at this point, I can actually decide how I want to show it. So there's no if tests or anything like that. It's just this one line that knows how to go off and then using that convention, show the particular object from that list. So the dynamic content control, it's actually quite another fairly simple control, I think. It's just based on content control. And its secret weapon is this select template line. So it goes in, it looks at the object that you've passed into it, and then it goes off and it actually goes and finds a template based on the same convention that we used earlier and grabs that out and creates a data template at runtime to be put into that square in the grid view. Okay, have I forgotten anything? Nope. Okay, so my new content there is a large tile view model. So it's come out of the list. The next one will be a small tile. The one after it will be a medium. You can see at this point the decisions are about to be made how to display that content. So I was able to shove it off over the other side of the fence to actually choose how to display it. So the actual template selector is probably the most trickiest bit out of all of it, but it's been pre-written luckily. So what I'm actually going to do is I'm going to go through here and we'll start seeing some familiar code. We get out the type name, in this case the large tile view. So it's actually used large tile view model. It's going to map it back to the large tile view. And this time it gets a little bit trickier because remember before we were able to just say frame.navigate to the type of the page. This time because we're working in a content control that requires a data template, not an instance of a control. They're a little bit different in the way they work. We actually have to manually build up some XAML. And so the actual XAML that we build is just a common old data template. Basically, it's just like a data template that you might see in any old piece of code that you've written yourself. And so it just puts in an instance of the large tile view. View in there, and then if we just pop back out, then it goes and runs it through the XAML reader. Now XAML reader is a built-in class that enables us to take any piece of XAML and dynamically parse it at runtime. So it's dynamically parsing out a data plate and returns an instance of it. And if I have a look at the instance, you probably can't see that down the back, but it is in fact a data template, which means that on the content control, when I get back to it, I can just set my own content template at runtime to be that data template. So, each of the dynamic content controls can all have a different data template simply based on the view model that's passed into them. And so we've got a whole couple of lines of code, and I've actually just managed to build a quite advanced grid view that's not at all easy to do dynamically. So we've got the large, we've got the medium, we've got the two skinnies, we've got a button that's a completely different content type. Over this side, we've got a second group, and this has just got all the same items in it. You can imagine that if I wanted to add a third group, All I need to do is just go and create a couple of view models, bang them into that same list, and it will go and figure it all out and display them on the screen as well. So it's using dynamic content selection in grid view is hugely important to being able to get these things out the door, and you'll waste so much time if you try and do that manually. I don't even know if you can. I don't even know if it can be done. So just quickly recap on that bit. Where are we? There we go. So the main idea is to allow dynamic selection of user controls. And basically that's it. I think that once you're able to start using these dynamically created user controls and start treating start relying on some more conventions rather than trying to hard code all this stuff, you can actually do some really, really great things with your code. And we're going to extend that even further now to see how to do the rest of all the Windows 8 cool things like semantic zoom and snapping and everything like that with the same controls. So another important feature, as I mentioned, of Windows 8 is semantic zoom. So the idea of semantic zoom is that on a slate or a smaller screen, some of the grid views that you get can get quite big. They can stretch right across the page. And so the idea is that you can just give it a little pinch zoom and it will zoom out a bit and so you can see more of that grid view. But that's not simply just a zoom out. When it zooms out, it actually changes the content to suit a zoomed out view more. And I'll give you an example of what that is, what that looks like in an application. So back in SPS, any app that supports semantic zoom will have this little minus button down the bottom corner there. And so obviously on my machine here, I don't have access to a touch screen. And when I click that, you'll notice that it has zoomed out, but it's actually gone and made the tiles smaller. It's removed the text from them. So it's giving us an overview of what's available in the list. And then basically I can click one of the items and I'll be taken to that section. Where it really gets cool is when I do something like this. Where are we? A to Z. Okay, lots of grouping on this screen. Once again, it's using all fully dynamic stuff, even though it's all got the same object on it. It doesn't need to resize them. And if I dynamically zoom out, this is where it gets really cool. So rather than showing a list of the items, I've actually gone and told it to show just the letter and how many items are in that group. So that's semantic zoom, and that's why it's really cool. You don't have to just show the list of items so I can get along and navigate through my application even easier. So you'd imagine that when you actually go and do semantic zoom stuff, before you realise that you could do dynamic content selection, you might imagine that if you want to have a different control or a different view as part of that semantic view, maybe one that doesn't have a text overlaying it, or the text might be smaller or might be a different colour or something like that, you might imagine that that's a whole second control that you need to write and somehow get it into that semantic zoomed list. But that is not the case because we know how to use all this dynamic stuff now. So let me just bring up my code notes here. Okay, so semantic zoom is actually a really, really simple control to use. What's more difficult is making sure that you don't replicate too much code when using it. So semantic zoom, it's just a control you can put in. And then it's got two properties. Zoomed out view, which is the when you've pinched to zoom out, and zoomed in view. So the zoomed in view was the one that I already had, so I'm just going to grab this grid view, paste it in there. The zoomed out view, on the other hand, slightly different. Home view. I'll run through the differences in two shakes. Okay, so first of all, I haven't put anything like in styles or templates or anything like that because I want to show the difference between two grids. In fact, I probably could have used just about the same piece of code for each, just changing a couple of their properties. So I've left it all in the page so that way we can see what's going on. So the zoomed out view, it just has another grid view in it. A couple of differences. First of all, Let's just go back to the zoomed in grid view. So this is the normal one. I've got the variable size wrap grid. Now, the way the variable size wrap grid works is it actually goes out and it makes a standard grid, just like this built into XAML, and actually puts rows and columns in it. And that way you can align your controls up to those rows and columns. And when done right, you actually get the squares like we saw in the grid view. Now, on the main one, I've made each of those squares 38 pixels. So my large tile view decides that it's going to be 10 wide. Sorry, yeah. It's going to be 10 of those 38 pixels wide, so it'll be 380. But it doesn't know how big each of those grid things are. It just knows it wants to be 10 of them. So the variable size wrap grid that I've got in the zoomed out one is only 19. It's half of that. So all of a sudden, my large tile view is only 10 times 19. It's just halved in size. It's gone to 190 in zoomed out view without me changing anything in the actual template itself, in the actual user control itself. Oops, I've copied too much code. Awesome. I copied the wrong grid twice, I think.
You wrote the previous one in below those
things. Oh, did I? I've pasted in again, yeah. Sweet, thanks. Oh, sorry, I didn't cut. Yep, good. Too easy. Okay. One semantic zoom, two semantic zoom. Excuse me. Okay. I was saying in my talk before, it's statistically proven that it's 72 times more difficult to debug code when you're doing a presentation. So, I mean, it looks the same at the moment because we're seeing that same view that we had before. But now I've got this semantic button down here. I didn't add it, it's just part of the control. And if I click it, you can see that it's gone and used that other variable size wrap panel and actually made the items smaller. But the problem we've got is that the items themselves don't really suit this size, do they? The text is too big. It doesn't really look quite right. So a bit more dynamic stuff. To the rescue. So what we can actually do is, you might remember before when we were looking at the templates here, I've got two dynamic controls, one for zoomed in and one for zoomed out. And they've actually got this other property here, state name. So I can use the same control, but because one's using the zoomed in template and one's using the zoomed out, I can say when the dynamic content control loads up my user control dynamically, I can actually pass into it a visual state to transfer to as soon as it loads. So visual state's another important part of all this. So visual state, if I go into my large tile view, the venerable large tile view, we finally meet. You can see large tile view model, it's got its C# file down there with nothing in it. Basically, visual states, you can do them in Blend. They're really easy to do. You can just use the designer to do them. But a visual state is basically a named state in the page that you can switch to based on what's going on in the code. So, and then each of the states is able to change or animate any of the other controls in the page. So in this case, I've got semantic state and non-semantic. And when I go to the semantic state, it goes off and finds the text box and adjusts its font size to be 10.667. Don't know why it chose that, but whereas originally it was 22. So we've seen how it dynamically loads the object from the list. Now the dynamic content control can actually work even harder and start passing down and say, hey, you need to switch to this state because you're in semantic view. Once this is all set up, you think about it for a moment. I can say to my designer, I need a large, a small, I need a medium, I need a button, I need all sorts of things. And they're like, yeah, cool. And because we've been using this pattern for years, the designer knows that they need to add the semantic state. They don't need to ask me how to do it. They just do it. And so by the time I get this off them and we slot it into the page, It just works. It's long established the way that we've worked. So no longer do we have to talk about how to do semantic zoom on every single object in our system. So you can see the large tile view has got completely unreadable text now. Pretty good design. But the rest of them haven't been touched. So we can go through and obviously update those at our leisure. Okay. More dynamic. So Windows 8 applications actually have a lot of different states they can run in. And I remember when we first started developing for Windows 8, we were thinking, oh God, you know, we've almost got to build the whole application three times. Because it's not just the home view, the main view with the main grid. And it's not just semantic zoom. We've also got to worry about snapped view, which if you've ever done if you've done a Windows 8 application before, it's very easy to think that the snap view is a complete redesign of the screen that you're trying to look at. And what we're about to see is where it's really, really important that we don't know what view we're going to show until the very last minute. So let's have a look at snapping. How can we use the same objects that we've just used, the same view models, but in a completely different way? Totally different. I'll just quickly show you guys what snapping is. So we've got a pretty big display here. The idea with snapping is I can actually grab that and pop that along the side of my project, and it snaps to the side of the screen. I can continue using it. I can navigate around like normal. So I can still go down here, and I can see all the pieces of content that I want to do. I can see, go to Programs A to Z, I can do all that sort of stuff. You notice it's pretty much the same content, but displayed in another way entirely again. And so that's snapped view. It's a pretty cool concept that Windows 8 have, especially once you get onto the tablets. So yeah, we can just go away, please. Back to our slides. So snapping is really, really cool, but if you don't do it properly, if you don't think about how to do it, you're going to end up doing so much extra work. So let's go and just very quickly, we're going to set up our homepage to be able to do some snapping. What page are we on? Home. There we are. Okay. So just at the top, I'm just going to get rid of the semantic zoom. So basically we're going to add in two grids, a snapped grid and a not snapped grid. Pretty obvious what they're going to do. So the not snapped grid, we just want to grab that semantic zoom doodad and whack it in there. How do I keep doing that? Okay, did I leave a bracket sitting around somewhere then? Oh, there it is. No, it isn't. Have I done that again? Let me just undo. Let's go back. I am the only experienced software developer in the world who doesn't know how to cut and paste, apparently. So we've got the snap grid and the not snap grid. And you can see that the snap grid is actually collapsed. Now, this is where it was important. Remember I said earlier that we were going to use the layout-aware page? Layout-aware page is a base class that comes when you file a new project. And basically, the layout-aware page is able to switch itself between snapped and non-snap view and orientations and do all that sort of stuff. So We need to remember that. Remember how I said it's got semantic zoom and snapped and all this stuff. It's also got all the orientations to worry about. So more dynamic things that you can do. More. So what I've done here, instead of actually having to paste all the code into the snap grid, I've just made a user control that I'll go and show you guys in a minute. And I've just got to paste in some visual states that actually do the snap changing. So the beauty of the way that the snap stuff works is that it's actually done using visual states again. So basically, the page just says to you, hey, I'm snapped. Can you just go to the snapped visual state? So the designer can go into Blend and actually just go and edit the visual states for snapped really, really easily. It's a really simple process for the designer to go through and do that. What isn't simple is for these child controls, which are listed all throughout the grids, to know when they're snapped. So same deal again. The actual snap view, remember before it wasn't a grid view, it was actually listed up and down. So I've actually decided in my snap view, I'm going to take the same content and view it in a list. So let's go and have a look at that guy. So once again, collection view source, just like before. But this time, instead of using a grid view, I'm actually using a list view, using the exact same data as before, so I have not modified this in any way. The only change that I've made to this entire thing from the grid view is called it a list view instead. And I've got another dynamic content control in there, and this time it's just passing in the state snap. So we've seen a few states now. We've seen semantic and snapped. Same principle again. So if I go through to my regular tile view this time, get rid of some of this green goo. All right, so I've got snapped and not snapped. And once again, same deal as before. I'm just, when we're in snap mode, I'm just going to make the regular tile view text a little bit smaller. Nothing too exciting, but you can see the idea. So run that guy up and snap it. Now, when I started this presentation, my application didn't have snap view in it. In fact, it wasn't even loading data. It wasn't creating view models. We're only 3/4 of the way through, and we've managed to do all of this stuff. That's pretty cool, hey? That same data is now using an entirely different entirely different visual state layout without me doing anything extra. My designer can now go away and make Snap look good. He can make Semantic look good. He can make the homepage look good. He can do all that without me even writing a single view model. It's completely detached. He can go into Blend and edit those states. So just quickly, I'll just show you what that looks like in Blend. So I go regular tile view model, edit with Blend, wait for it to connect to TFS. And voila.
Jordan, is there two snap states? You've got that wrapping of it and taken across like 3/4, 2/3 of the screen.
No, so the 2/3 is normal. It's normal size. Yeah, it just brings it in a bit. Yep. So you can see here I've got the states that actually show up, and I can edit them completely in Blend. So my designer, because we've got this long-standing convention that we use a snap view, snap state across all our controls. He just knows to go in and do that before I even tell him anything. He knows how to do it. Okay. Sounds a bit zen, really, doesn't it? So, yeah, what about dynamic states within oneself? What about choosing a state when you're within the user control? So far, we've been fed the states from outside. Whether or not it's sort of like a wider scale change to the application, so whether or not you've been semantics or whether or not you've been snapped. But the actual view models themselves, they've got a park on them. They've got this piece of content that can have important things. So, for example, a park has got certain attributes, like does it have barbecues? Does it have toilets? And you start thinking, how do I change my view around depending on whether they have these things? I've got an image there you might have seen on some of the items that's a toilet logo. I want to be able to change that around without actually writing any code because that would be silly. Then the code would know about the view. We don't do that. So what we can actually do is using visual states, we can actually use a special little controller we can insert in our XAML called data state behavior. And it actually allows us to dynamically choose state from within the user control itself. So we know that parks have got toilets, and we know that we want to maybe go to the toilet state or not. So it's actually really simple to do. So let's have a look at that. Okay, sorry, I'll just catch up here. Right. We're in the right spot. So let me just comment out this guy here, and we'll just quickly run through it. Now, I don't have a lot of time to actually go through this, but I've got a link to a blog post that explains what's going on with the data state behaviors in great detail. But basically, Windows 8 actually removed behaviors for the time being. I'm not sure if they're going to add them in later, hopefully so. But it's okay, you can actually get around it because a guy on the internet that's way smarter than me re-implemented them. Apologies, I can't remember his name, you'll have to see my blog post, he gets full credit. What I did do though is I actually went along and wrote the data state behavior that's sitting inside there. Now, What a behavior does is it basically, when it fires up at runtime, it is it able to attach and using the properties that it's set can actually run some code. It's very generic though. So you can see here the binding name is called park.toilets. So we want to that's the property on park that we want to track. If park.toilets is true, go to the true state, which is has toilets, or otherwise go to the false state, which does not has toilets. So you can see here I've got the toilet group, and no toilets, the image is going to be collapsed, otherwise we'll just leave it alone because it's already visible. So now if I go and run this guy, zing, what time is it? You can see there's one there that's got toilet. It's automatically been done. Now, snap. Oh, snap. Same thing. I've just gone to the other view here, and it's still working. Like, I can still see that state's all been passed down. So I've just done in one spot, and beautiful. We've got toilet switching on and off. Yes?
How would you use behavior if you can also just bind straight to the property and manipulate that to the
Yeah, good question. So the question is, I could have bounced straight to the property on the park and done a I-value converter, which knows a little bit about the view. I don't like them, but the main point is that I could have bound to the Boolean value toilets, run an I-value converter that then returns an opacity value, which is okay in certain cases. The beauty with visual states is, by switching between visual states, the designer can do much more than just turn things on and off. They could make something a little bit higher. They could make one example for a different state is that view all button's a lot higher and the actual text is aligned differently. You wouldn't want to code each one of those up. So a state can do a whole bunch of changes and it can all be done in Blend. Keep an eye on that view all button just here. It's actually square and a bit higher in there. So it's actually changing around based on where it is. And so that's what's good about states. They don't have to do any coding or anything like that or any binding. They just write the states, and then we just dump a data state control on top of it, and it just flips through them really quickly. Also with data state, states, you can actually animate the transition between them, so you can have something fade in and out, which you can't do with binding. So you can do all sorts of other cool stuff as well. So, Just to really finish off, we've only got a couple of minutes left. We've got a home view here, which I'm already on. And I just want to grab a piece of code and put it into my home view. And this is how simple it is to go to the next object. All right, so basically what I'm doing is when I click on one of the objects, I come through this method, and then I have to, there's just a little bit of link there because I have to go and find the group that was clicked. So, you know, I've got all these groups across the page. And so what I'm doing is I'm going to find, hey, which group's got the list of parks that I just... which group does the park that I just clicked, which group is that in? And then I grab out that list of groups. So now I've got the whole selection of the parks. What I can then do is I can go var vm equals create content model. So this is creating a content model inside another view. And I'm just going to pop that guy up. And we'll call it park model. And then we can actually configure this guy. So first of all, we're going to go a.parks equals that parent group items. So the view model obviously takes a list of parks. I don't know why it does, but it just does, and I know that I need to put it in there. And we also need to know the selected park, apparently. So I go a.selected park equals this guy. Just got to find out what that is. There we go. Dot park. All right. So I've created the view. This is me showing how easy it is to navigate to something and configure it. And you'll see why I'm passing all that junk in. And then I can just go navigate to right within the view model, the VM. Run it up. Hopefully nothing's broken. What I've just done is I've actually linked up the click on these guys. So now I can actually go into a park and view its details. So that's why selected park was there. What you might notice is this is actually a flip view, so I can actually go through all the parks. So that's why I needed the list of parks. And I did that with just a couple lines of code. The most complex bit was the link to actually go and grab the parks out. It wasn't anything to do with loading things up in a view. It was simply the actual navigation and display of that was actually really, really simple. So I think that just about does us. Let's have a look here. The end. Is there any questions? Yes. So you just what you do is you fire a command back into the view model and just adjust the list. Sorry? Oh, okay. I'll talk to you about that. Come up and see me after, actually. There's a blog post there on the dynamic state stuff. There's all the code for this session. This backing service that it uses has got some cool web API stuff in that. And also my phone talk earlier is up there on the site. I have nothing to give away, so how about that? Sorry. Yes.
MVVM's been around for a long time now. Why isn't this kind of stuff baked in? Like, why isn't it out of the box?
Because Microsoft isn't a patents and practices company out of the box. They do some of this stuff and supply it. I should have mentioned, there's actually a couple of really good MVVM frameworks. Caliban Micro is very, very convention-based, very similar technique to this. Another one's called Okra, O-K-R-A, and that's a really lightweight convention-based view model system. Or you can just download this stuff and use it. I like using my own because it's just a really simple, small framework that that does everything. So I think that's time, isn't it? So thank you very much for coming along today. I hope it didn't melt too many brains. If I did, come and see me, and happy to run through anything. So thank you very much.